everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
Dawn Keatley.
And on today's episode, we're revisiting the seemingly sleepy town of Ludlow, Maine. Based on Stephen King's 1983 novel Pet Sematary, the story of the Creed family is a dark foray into the depths of parental grief and desperation. The original 1989 film captured these elements, but does the new version? Comparisons between the two films are inevitable. And so today we're asking if, maybe, just maybe, Sometimes Dead really is better, especially when it comes to horror remakes. So stay tuned. So, what did everyone think about our latest adaptation of Mr. Stephen King's work?
Well, I'll go first. I think if I had never seen the 1989 film, I probably would have liked this film a lot better. I just didn't care for the changes. I think I struggled too much with it, and there was more negatives than positives. It was still a very good film, but now it's no for me.
Good, okay, but not great. I kind of actually feel pretty much the way that you do. I feel I would have liked it a lot more if I hadn't watched the 1989 film, which we did a podcast about pretty recently. And I remember as we talked about that, I became so much more enthusiastic about the 1989 film. Mm-hmm. And in rewatching it and watching the documentary about it. And I just feel, you know, I watched this about 5 days ago and it's sinking in my memory.
Yeah.
It didn't leave an impression. Sorry.
Uh-oh. I think I'm the third no for this one. And I think I enjoy it when I think about it as a horror comedy film. Because
yes.
There were multiple times that we laughed in the theater. And it was completely unintentionally. But it doesn't matter. It was still enjoyable from that perspective. But as a horror film, I kept asking myself, why? Why did they remake it from the original? And I know the original is completely campy and is not everybody's cup of tea. But there was just nothing in this film that I thought was even remotely interesting when compared against the original. And the one twist of Ellie dying, which, oh yeah, spoilers, guys. But honestly, the trailer gave
it
away.
Yeah.
And for the life of me, I could not understand why the trailer would spoil that, because that's the one shock moment. So yeah, it's a no for me too.
And can I just add, this film was in no way intended to be a comedy.
No.
So when you're saying, Liz, that it was funny, that's not a good thing.
And I think Liz and I had this discussion too, that it was almost like the film was created for people that had seen the original and it was trying to throw us off. So,
yes.
Okay,
oh, yes.
You know, for those of you guys that had saw the original and you loved it so much, you might be expecting a scalpel to be going across somebody's Achilles
right now,
but it's not gonna. Hey, for those of you that had watched the original film, I know you thought that Gage was gonna die, but, I think that led it astray sometimes, is trying to throw those of us that loved the original off.
Yeah, and I have to say, with the Achilles heel thing, I was obviously expecting Judd to get his Achilles heel slashed by Ellie when he was standing by the bed. And when he didn't, I actually was writing a note about the fact that he didn't have his Achilles heel slashed and totally missed the actual, or, you know, like missed when she actually did slash it.
But you didn't miss much.
Yeah.
No. Like, it wasn't as grotesque.
I'm glad I missed it.
It wasn't as visceral, I think, as the original.
Yeah. No.
It was quick.
I mean, is that something interesting about the film, maybe? That it does sort of do those sort of gotcha moments, like the sort of nod to the viewer of the 89 film? Like, I'm going to give you this. You think you know what's coming, but then you don't. I mean, I was really, I actually was kind of pulled in when Gage started running toward the road. I was like, wait, what's happening? Gage isn't supposed to be the one to get killed in this version, I heard. So
that still was a good moment. I mean, I'll give the film that. It still had good moments, but I think it would have been more impactful if those plot switches were meaningful, if they added to the story.
Oh, good point. You want meaning.
Yeah. Or, you know, even added shock. Like, it didn't, like, none of them really added something like overly horrific, memorable, or anything to me.
And I think what contributed to it, too, is that we were dealing with a subpar Gage. And I know that's kind of harsh because it's a little child. But this Gage didn't incite any sort of, like, affection for the character at all. I felt like he was just plopped in. So when he he's running to the street. I mean, this comes on the heels of other sort of unintentional comedic moments. And I thought, if this kid face plants and then gets run over, I'm going to start to laugh. And I know that's not the intention. So, yeah, it just didn't work for me. Like, especially in terms of, like, how the story flowed. There was no building of dread for me at all at any moment. I mean, even the stuff with Zelda that we talked about, that was pure comedy as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, we're going to have to devote a whole section to that.
Yeah, I know. It just...
As far as Gage, I felt like from a casting standpoint, they casted somebody that almost looked like Miko, like the original actor. But outside of that, he was a take it or leave it character in this current film for me. Like, he didn't really have any point.
No, I agree.
Well, I wonder if, I mean, because the decision was made to focus on Ellie, and I thought she was the star of the show, Jete Lawrence, maybe because the decision was made to focus on Ellie, they just let Gage drop, I guess, and the parents, especially the father, seemed to pay more attention to Ellie. So her character was developed in relationship to her parents way more than Gage was.
And I think I probably would have been fine with that if not for the ending, because for the ending to be impactful, that you know this child is about to be consumed or something is going to happen with the parents to bring him back into the family fold. I just didn't care. I thought,
Again, if I had never seen the 89 film, I would have really enjoyed Ellie's character a lot. I would have been like, yeah, she's one evil kid. And I would have enjoyed seeing her dance around in that tutu and smashing stuff around the house. And I would have enjoyed that, I think. But knowing what we know, no, I can't.
I guess for me, she didn't read as evil as much as traumatized. And so it impacted me differently. Like, because when she's spinning around and she's being really destructive, you don't get sort of the same moment from the 1989 where you see Gage and he's got the little scalpel and he looks downright evil. Like, he wants to cut someone.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Whereas she's just sort of acting out like, how dare you bring me back to life?
I'll give you that.
And I liked that. I mean, that you may have identified the one part of the film that I did like. You know, like the moment where she says to her dad, I'm dead, aren't I? Or something.
I mean, loved that.
That's completely an invention of this particular version.
Yeah.
And it was the strongest part of it. And her eyes are just so sort of dark and not evil dark, but I traumatized totally and bewildered and confused. Yeah.
Well, I guess we should get into some of the major changes between, I guess, the book, the 89 film and the current film.
There are a lot.
There definitely are. So what are some of the major changes that we want to touch on?
Well, I know you love Zelda. Do you want to just kick it off with Zelda?
Yeah, I guess we could start there because I might not be able to focus on anything else until we get there. I think in the current film, they gave precedence to the appearance of Zelda and trying to go for that shock factor. Yeah. And I don't think it worked for me. Because, yes, she appeared horrific. However, she's not a movie monster. And I think that that's what people forget. She's not a movie monster.
Right.
She's somebody that has a disease, is dying, and that kind of brings grief upon her family. So she's a mechanism for grief in the original film and the original book. And in this one, she just became a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care for that. And I feel like they completely removed her story. The amount of time she had on screen was less, as well as the amount of backstory that you had for her was less. I don't need to see her twisted back to understand who she is, what she is. And I think that that was kind of a disservice to disability. I lost her story, and that hurt me a lot.
She didn't have a backstory.
No.
I mean, all I remember of Zelda from this film is, like, shots of her back and her face being kind of cut off. Like, I don't even really remember very many shots of her face. It's just that twisted back that looked like some, like, alien or the thing or something.
And I feel
she
like
was utterly dehumanized.
In the original, I understood a much more comprehensive sense of dread just from her being in this back bedroom going, Rachel. Which, shout out to my friend Rachel, because she is forever traumatized by that soundbite. But, you know, it didn't have to make her a monster. And I think that they also emphasized, too, that we pushed her away into a back bedroom in the 89 film. Mm-hmm. Like, it was our dirty little secret that none of us knew how to deal with or whatever. And we kind of took that out, which I guess then will eventually tap into the idea that they completely took the in-laws out of the picture or Rachel's parents out of the picture, which is a problem.
I mean, I completely agree with you. And I think the problem for me was that it made it absolutely impossible to build empathy for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
So not only did you not get empathy for Zelda, yeah. you also don't build empathy for Rachel and yeah. what she endured. And by eliminating especially like the scene of the soup
yeah.
and watching how difficult it is for Rachel to help feed her sister, as well as for Zelda to sort of receive that help and know that she's never going to get better. Yeah. It just took sort of like that core emotion from the original and completely deleted it. And then when you add to that, taking Zelda after you've honed in on her body and use that as the point of disgust, and then throw her down a dumbwaiter.
Yeah.
Like, yo, all I could think about was this happened on like a 1987 episode of Webster. You would go up and down the dumbwaiter. I'm like, if they put her in there, and then sure enough, there she was. And I'm like, I'm out.
And the fact that you and I laughed out loud for a good 10 minutes. I mean, a good 10 minutes.
Annoying everyone in the movie theater.
Oh, yeah.
At the same
absolutely.
Yeah, I think if they could have kicked us out, they
They probably would. I mean, we laughed to the point of tears at Zelda falling down the dumbwaiter. Yeah, it was it's to the true. Point of tears and like gasps. that means that they completely did wrong by her.
Absolutely.
There was no sympathy for her. You completely used her disability
as a trope. You
guys are a
little messed up?
No. Well, I know I am.
Messed up.
Right.
I know I'm
this
messed up.
This just confirmed it.
But I think the fact that we could laugh at that,
yeah.
again, takes away from both Zelda and Rachel. Because in the original film, that death is just this kind of cathartic moment for Rachel where she's just like, yeah, I kind of was happy. And oh my God, it's over. And so it builds her story, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you still felt that sympathy for Zelda, like, it's
right.
over. You choked on your soup, and yeah.
And there's a poignancy there that sort of underscores why Rachel carries that trauma with her
correct.
And carries it forward, because the way it is in the remake, she just threw the food up the dumbwaiter.
Yeah.
She didn't actually have any sort of contributing factor in Zelda's death, really.
Whoops.
Whereas in the original, exactly, she was actually like feeding her.
Yeah.
So she was sort of like the mechanism in a way.
They gave up that emotional complexity and mm-hmm. exchanged it for creepy sounds in the walls.
Yeah.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
which sort of then merge with the creepy sounds in the woods, which I guess we're supposed to think is the Wendigo, and just kind of reinforces Zelda as some monster mm-hmm. rather than a human.
That's a good point.
Who was yeah. connected to her sister. I mean, in every way, like by the visuals, by the plot, she's just turned into something monstrous.
And I think it's just an example of how the film really privileges the father's grief over the mother's grief, because I got no sense of Rachel's grief, really. But we definitely heard from Lewis.
Yeah.
And even just that singular shot of Lewis with the little tear sliding down his cheek, yet another moment where I laughed out loud inappropriately.
Yeah, as I'm still laughing.
I know. Yeah. It was just so overdramatic, and which is so funny because when you consider the 1989 one, it's a cheese fest. And I'm yeah. definitely, out of the three of us, I'm the less enthusiastic about it. But comparing it against this one, it feels like this emotional treaty on grief.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to
you're finally
yeah.
on
what
our
we
side.
Got. I am now.
Yeah. So where do we go with this? Do we go to the Wendigo or do we go on to Rachel's grief?
I think we got to talk about the Wendigo.
Yeah. I feel like it was a good segue that Dawn was talking about.
Yeah. yeah.
So how do we feel about the treatment of that?
And the Wendigo was in the novel. So the directors here are going back to the King's source, but it was not in the 1989 version. There's got to be something to the fact that we only see it in a book. Lewis sees it on the internet, right?
Yeah.
He sees a picture on the internet. We don't see it in the woods, though maybe we hear it. But I guess I read somewhere in the New Republic, I think it was, A.A. Dowd's article in the New Republic, that the Wendigo seems designed to absolve white people for the fact that the Native Americans left this land in the North Woods. Because, as Judd says in this film, the local tribes fled. They came to believe those woods belonged to someone else. And the someone else he's referring to is the Wendigo. So it was the Wendigo that drove the local tribes out of the North Woods, the Wendigo and the Sourland. And this, I hadn't thought about this. It's a good point. It kind of does suggest that what the film is then doing, like its project, is about absolving white people from grabbing Native American lands. Now, there's one fleeting mention. Again, this is done through the internet. Lewis sees a newspaper clipping that says, quote, "Indian land claims unsettled." And that's something that goes back to the novel, where there are sort of unsettled land claims. There's a dispute going on. And I think in the novel, that's why Judd says, no one's going to build on your land, to Lois. So this whole idea of whites and Indians sort of fighting over land right is only in this one little tiny clipping. And then the Wendigo kind of takes care of the whole problem after that. It was just the Wendigo.
So you're telling me this is a horror comedy?
This is. Because,
and this isn't some white guilt here. This is like history.
Well, I mean, what did you think of the Wendigo? The Wendigo that
First of
we
all,
don't actually ever see.
Correct. Yeah. Except for in that, I call it a fairy book. Because when I was growing up, I used to sit in the little local library and look at fairy books. So it was like fairies, gnomes, trolls. And it looked like an illustration right out of there. And so my head went there. And I felt like it was this kind of apology for the 1989 film because it really wasn't touched upon.
Yeah.
So we're going to just throw it in there like a recipe, just a dash of Wendigo, a dash of some, you know, forgiving the white people. I don't know. And in doing so, so superficially, I think it did more damage than adding it in. Because I know that we had talked about it during our original podcast about the 89 film, that it completely whitewashed that narrative from the novel. This, I think, was almost worse.
It's just fascinating to me that they're trying to be more politically correct in this film, and yet it's so much worse.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So much worse.
Like, give me the, you know, Poltergeist film. I think they even did a better job with talking about, you know, Native American burial grounds than this did. I don't know. And I think that they didn't really do anything, any justice to the history of the land. They just made it about this supernatural beast. In a way that I still wouldn't understand what the heck that had to do with the land.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's another thing that mitigates the grief that is so powerful in the novel and in the 89 film because, you know, I think Judd again says at some point there's something about the power of that place, something about that place brings you back up there, makes you back up there, brings things back from the dead. And it always feels like he's kind of literally referring to the Wendigo. Like, that's this spirit that draws people back, kind of curses them. But it's not. It's about the grief. But they're placing grief with Wendigo.
That's a good point.
So
that actually makes a lot more sense to me right now.
Well, it's just part and parcel of the Zelda thing, too.
And I mean, when you think about it, though, like, that explanation was really interesting to me. And honestly, when I watched the movie, I got none of that. But I completely buy it. And when taken in conjunction with the issues with Pascal.
Yes.
There's some really troubling
racial
things happening in this film. So Pascal.
Yeah. Get into that, Liz.
You blink and you miss him. So how do we begin to talk about Pascal?
Oh, just throw it out on the line, dude.
I mean, for me, honestly, it just struck me as an example of tokenism.
Yeah.
The fact that you are going to have Pascal now played by an African-American actor is fantastic if you keep Pascal's story.
Yeah.
But when you suddenly take that story, which was so interesting, and he was this great sort of harbinger of doom or salvation, depending on whether you listen to him or not, he was sort of the one who was like the voice of reason amongst all the chaos. And so then when you strip that story away and you just see him as something grotesque, it's the Zelda issue as well. You're using a physical body just to create disgust, but you're robbing him of his whole story, his whole backstory, so that we can build empathy for him and then also how he's supposed to play into the narrative. So I was just super disappointed by the fact that they, to me, just got rid of all of it.
Well, then again, I think when we were in the movie theater, too, I leaned over and I was like, oh, so you're going to kill the black guy first again.
Right.
Which, so I think hand in glove with what you're saying is, first of all, you're going to make him African-American and kill him right away, which is just like every criticism that's ever been about horror films.
Completely.
And then
valid
number
criticism.
Two, take away all of his story. So you put those two together. That's a huge issue.
Yeah.
You know, he was barely even a memorable character except for somebody looking at him on the gurney saying his brains are coming out. Like, that's what you remember the most.
I mean, why'd they do it? I don't know. I guess they were just sort of going down the list of characters and like, okay, they're all white. Like, where can
we insert someone,
the tokenism? Where can we insert someone who's not white? And, you know, well, it can't be Judd and it can't be the Creed. So next up.
Which
is so frustrating because why couldn't it be the Creeds? Why couldn't it have been Judd? You know, it could have been any of the characters. But I mean, I was troubled enough by that. But now taken in conjunction with what you've described for the Wendigo, now I really hate this film.
He didn't seem like as much of a moral authority as the Pascal in the original did.
Right, right. And I thought that was a big mistake, especially too because you didn't have that one final scene of Rachel interacting with Pascal.
That's right. Yeah.
And without that connection,
that's right,
it didn't build any sort
of
joy.
It's just Gage, right?
Yeah.
Which, again, was less effective than Ellie because Gage doesn't even have the language to really even be conveying, hey, Pascal said this. Yeah. So it's just kind of like, and that's not as scary. Again, it became another moment that I was like, really?
Yeah.
Did we just, okay.
Yeah.
We're having the 3-year-old do that. Okay.
I was really disappointed with how that story played out.
So then we have Judd. We haven't talked about him and...
Judd.
His character also changed, I think, and not for the better.
Agreed.
I mean, maybe in two ways. First of all, he and Lewis, we never really see them bonding at all. I mean, and that really seemed to be kind of a center of the 89 film.
And the book.
And, you know, I kind of liked the Judd-Ellie relationship, except it wasn't developed as much as it needed to be. But then also, don't you guys think that what Judd knows seems different in this film?
Yeah,
like,
agreed.
He's the one that tells the story of the Vietnam vet, right? Bateman, and the house goes up on fire after his father brings him back. So in the 89 version, Judd really knows what he's doing when he takes Lewis to the burial ground. Here, he's sort of like, well, I know my dog came back a little vicious, but he was mean anyway. And that's all that Judd seems to know, unless I'm missing something.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. He kind of just seemed like this goofy, and even though he wasn't a drunk, he kind of just came across like this benevolent drunk that is lingering around, and he was very apologetic, like, oh, I'm so sorry I did that. I didn't really mean to take you to this sour ground and bring these demons into your life and ruin everything forever. Oops. And again, too, I think for me, like you said it earlier, you love John Lithgow, but for me, it will never be a Fred Gwynne. And again, it all I could see is Harry and the Hendersons. And I was stuck in that because we were in the woods with John Lithgow hearing strange noises come through the woods.
We were in the CGI woods.
We were in the CGI woods.
Which made it worse.
With lots and lots of fog. More fog than I've ever seen before in my life.
In Maine or Quebec, which is where it was filmed. Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, I think that they really took away his knowledge, his information, his intent, as well as his bond.
And his culpability.
Correct. Yes.
I mean, everything. He really didn't seem to know what he was doing. He didn't tell Lewis what he was doing when they took Church and buried Church. And that was just more absolving of white people of their guilt in some ways.
It was a really strange decision, I thought, too, because the original, there was sort of this really interesting undercurrent of, can you trust Judd? Can you not?
Yeah.
Where is he coming from on this? Why is he so adamant in pushing Lewis to explore the burial ground? And in this one, when you take all that away, the only interesting thing I really noticed in Judd was the brief mention of his wife at the very end, because I'm like, that's the backstory I want.
Okay.
I want to know
movie.
What happened. Yeah, I would watch that movie.
Do you think he brought his wife back? I mean, because at the end, doesn't Ellie, somebody appears as his wife to him.
Ellie.
And I wondered if, I mean, and this would very much contradict what I just said about Judd and seeming to have no real knowledge of what the burial ground does. But I guess I wondered if that meant that he had tried bringing Norma back.
Because there was that comment about, you know what you did.
Right.
You know what you did. And again, I feel like this was almost like another little token, because in the book, you understand that bond between Judd and Lewis came because Lewis was helping with the caretaking of the wife.
Right.
And so there's that masculine bond that forms that we completely lose. So it was like, oh, we're going to kind of bring her back and give you a little Easter egg, but not exactly tell you why.
Right.
And I think that really threw me off. Like,
I think
I lost sight of a lot there.
Yeah, I think the implication was definitely that he had done that with his wife, but I don't think that necessarily contradicts what you said, because we weren't given enough.
Yeah. We were given
really
nothing.
No, right. You just have, again, Easter egg is the perfect word for it. And honestly, all I kept thinking about from that point forward was, why am I not watching that movie?
Yeah, I was going because, straight Grease. I was like, tell me more, tell me more. I just wanted to know what happened there.
Right. So that was frustrating.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Another thing that I really thought was sort of a mistake on the part of the filmmakers is eliminating the church scene where you see see Rachel's parents, especially the father, go in on Lois and blame him. And it's such like a visceral, raw scene. And it's funny because I was doing some research and I found out that Mary Lambert, who was the director of the original, had to fight to keep that scene because the production company was afraid that it was too real and it was too much of a depiction of grief. And I felt like...
We can't do that.
No, God forbid. Yeah. And just eliminating that from the story, as well as the fact that the only interaction that you see between Lois and Rachel's father is they kind of just like nod to each other
and
she's getting into the car. And I'm like, well, where's the dynamic? Where's the masculine bond and sort of the fraying and how that happens, especially in light of grief? None of that. And I just found that incredibly frustrating.
No, I agree with you. I think that the original film was very much about this is men's business and men's heart are stonier and whatnot. And that's kind of lost.
Yeah. Totally lost.
As well as, too, that it's a larger family affair. It's not just a nuclear family affair. It's grief is something that just kind of trickles throughout. And when they took away that fight between, you know, Rachel's parents and Lewis, I think that you lost a huge amount of grief because grief has big implications on a family, lasting implications on a family. And I think that one of the, and maybe what it comes down to is one of the biggest removals from this film is Mary Lambert, because I think that what she added to the original film is so many important shots, so many important decisions and casting calls. Because and this will come to church. I know you guys laugh at me about church, but just even that decision to flip around the lens, which if you watch that Unearthed and Untold documentary, they talk about they flipped around the lens on the camera to make the eyes of the cat reflect. That was horrific to see that cat eyes, you know, reflecting back at you. That's what made it so scary too. And so maybe it's just she did something so fantastic that I'm struggling with some of these things.
Do you think that it matters if it's a female directing the film versus a male?
Yeah,
you just went all in. Do you think there's a different sensibility or can you generalize like that?
I mean, Hereditary was directed by a man. I mean, and that's pretty.
And that was a very good film.
Powerful.
That was a very good
portrait
film.
Portrait of grief.
I agree with you. That was one of the few films, which is funny because we actually talked about Hereditary in relation to this film too, not too long ago. And I think that that was a really good film. And I think that that was one of the few films in the last at least decade that I was like, you just did that? So I'm not saying that it has to be a woman, but I do think that she
just. In this case,
she was just unique and she had an eye for art and she really brought that art to the screen.
Well, again, in doing a little research, I found out that of the 40-some and counting theatrically released adaptations of King's work, only two have been directed by women.
Wow.
And what's, that actually stunned me.
Yeah, that did. What's the other one?
I don't have that in my notes.
Sorry. You dropped the ball
there. I'm going to have to Google. But that actually really did surprise me because King is such a vociferous supporter of women on Twitter.
Yeah.
That just blew my mind. But I'm, in general, very curious about this film. Like, one, why didn't King make a cameo like he did in the original? Two, why did he not insist that it's going to be filmed in Maine, like the original?
Good point.
There's so many like little elements. It almost feels like maybe he was more removed from this because I know in the research that did not give you the answer to that, it did say that on set, Mary Lambert would have to run through King any decisions that she wanted to make that were a little bit different from the book and just to get the get his permission. And I mean, that's problematic to me on a lot of levels.
Yeah, it is, especially if,
if there's only two.
Especially if these two men, Kolsch and Widmeyer, didn't have to run everything by King themselves.
Right. So I'm in general curious about how this movie came to be, but I couldn't really find anything that really discussed those particular type of differences.
I saw a couple of headlines that just seemed to suggest that King liked this adaptation and particularly the ending. I don't know, maybe he's mellowing with age. Doesn't need to keep so much control over things. I mean, the fact that it was not filmed in Maine, I think, was really a problem. I mean, I thought that was fantastic in the 1989 version. And it showed, like, the landscape in that film, it was amazing. And here, yeah, I don't know. It just, it feels unreal, unearthly, especially, obviously, all the Beyond the Barrier burial ground scenes that are shot at night, just utterly fake. That really detracted from the mood for me.
Even the little scene of when Lewis first encounters Pascal and he wakes up in the bed and he's got, like, the dirt, even that didn't look real.
What I was thinking about when we were watching the movie, too, is what happened to the housekeeper?
There, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
She's totally gone.
She's absolutely gone. And again, I think that that's another removal of grief.
Yeah, it is. Another removal of dealing with death in some way.
Yeah. And because
she committed suicide. Susan Blumbard. Yes. Yes. I love her.
And what I find so interesting is that I see the novel as a book about, and I know that that's some of the stuff that made it so hard for Stephen King to want to publish it in the first place, because there was so much realness in it and so much grief in it and so much, I hate to say taboo, but things that people, you know, when you see that infant's casket going into the ground or that funeral, that makes it very real. But that's what made that book and that original film so amazing. And even to take away her story, I think this film just removed not all of the grief, but 98% of it.
And it removed a lot of the women. I mean, they're counting up here. I mean, the housekeeper's gone. Norma is gone, Judd's wife. Zelda's virtually gone. Rachel's mother is a non-character, though I think she's there. I can't even remember what she looked like. And also, Rachel herself. I mean, we haven't really talked about her yet. I mean, you guys have talked about the church scene's gone. Her grief is gone. I mean, that was one moment in the film after Ellie had died, where at some point I was like, whoa, wait, what happened? Like, where did all the grieving go?
Right.
It was like, it was over in a second, and Rachel is calmly getting into the car to leave.
And we were talking about this earlier. I had read a review online talking about how this film is great for Rachel's story because it makes her strong and she's not this sad, traumatized woman. And they kind of termed that as her agency. And I was like, whoa, that's not agency. It doesn't make you weak to have endured and survived half of the things that she had to, A, as a child, and then B, with the loss of a child. You're not a bad or sad person because you're hurt. And I think that when they removed her hurt, they actually took away her agency. I felt like she had much more of a human, realistic, tangible story in the 89 film, because I was like, oh my, I couldn't imagine growing up the way she did. I couldn't imagine what she dealt with the loss of Gage. So I didn't see that as making her stronger.
It was a real absence there, I thought. And then the film switches to Lewis. I mean, this film is more about men than it is about women, and more about men than I think the 89 version was.
Which is interesting, since Ellie's
except for
the
Ellie.
Main character, so it's kind of funny that it takes like an adolescent girl can be put front and center, but they remove the women. I know.
No, I'm laughing because my head went somewhere else. So my head just immediately went, because we were talking about Lewis and, like, you know, the story of men. And when you were talking about that shot with that one tear rolling down his face, it made me think of that commercial of the Indian that litters.
Or
sees somebody littering.
From the 70s.
Yes. And he sees somebody, and that one tear goes down his face.
Can't
and I was like,
see that.
I'm like, no. I don't know.
That's like a drop of Visine that the AD put in his eye just to give an illusion of grief, which is ridiculous. But I like that the man can only have that single solitary tear instead of actually having a breakdown, which you would think most people, regardless of their gender, would have if you're putting your child into the ground.
Well, apparently this film sees strength in denying your feelings.
Yeah.
Or just kind of keeping it moving. And moving towards our family values, because that's where the film goes.
That is where the film goes.
Well, it's where the film starts and then where it ends. I mean, it's all, they come back to, or they come to this place somewhere in Quebec from Boston so they can be more of a family again. And not that ever really seems to happen. But then, the ending, which keeps them together as a family, which it seems like they never really could be when they were all alive. So what did y'all think of the ending?
So first of all, that was another horror comedy moment for me. So as Lewis is about to, first of all, he picks his kid. So whenever you say that nobody has a favorite child, apparently Lewis does, because he goes off to save Ellie. And he locks Gage in the car, which again, probably not the most nurturing thing you could do is lock your child in the car, but okay. And then when he leans over and goes, Gage, don't let anybody in the car. I was like, did you just tell your kid don't let anybody in the car?
He's like two and a half, three years old.
I don't even know if he knows what you're talking about. The one redeeming character, not the one, but one of the redeeming characteristics of the film is when I thought that Lewis was going to go off into the woods and slaughter Ellie. Like, yes, when I thought that shovel was going to come down on her throat, I was about to cheer out loud into the crowd.
Agreed.
And it didn't happen.
So why would that have been a better move if he had
Because at least it would have been different. I mean, maybe for me, like, because they were building Ellie up as this, you know, movie monster, and she was becoming the threat. And I kind of did want it to end. And I felt like for it to end and to go back to a good, normal, happy life, sometimes you got to put out the trash, and she was the trash.
I had a slightly different take on to why I wanted him to kill her, though, because, you know, all the way leading up to that, you realize that Ellie is, again, traumatized by being brought back. Yeah. Her father did it because of his own, he couldn't deal with his own grief.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was hoping that he would kill her because that would be a signal that he cared more about Ellie's suffering than he did his own.
Yeah.
And ultimately,
or Gage.
Well, poor Gage. Yeah. I mean, being locked in the car, that was so ridiculous to me. It was hard for me to even wrap my mind.
Well, and keeping your dead sister around isn't really good for Gage either. Let's kind of put that out on the table. So he wasn't really thinking about Gage on any level in a protective capacity.
No, he was literally just thinking about himself. I don't even think he was considering Rachel's grief. And in the original, I definitely got more of a sense that he was driven because of Rachel's breakdown as a result of Gage's death. Whereas in this one, it really seems to be all about
all
Lewis.
Him. Yeah, that is a very good point. In the 1989, he does seem, I mean, because Rachel's character is so much more developed and because of her relationship with Zelda, Lewis definitely seems driven by helping her out, by helping her deal with what he thinks is just, he thinks she's not going to be able to survive that grief, I think, in the 1989 version. In this version, it's so clear that Rachel will and that Lewis is completely doing it for himself.
So how do we feel about the fact that certain characters didn't die? Like, well, again, I guess, because if you think about it, in the 89 film, he has to put Church back down.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really happen. Has to put Gage back down. Doesn't really happen. Yeah, well, Ellie was kind of a non-entity as far as putting her down in this case. But again, that doesn't happen. It's almost like they have to put him down so we can be a happy family again, with the implication that they're probably going to kill Gage too.
Oh, yeah. That's how I took the ending.
Because I can't imagine they're going to let him just go on living.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that child's going to die one way or the other. Either they're going to kill him
or they'll leave him in the car.
He's going to dehydrate being locked in a car.
Yeah.
They're going to kill him. I mean, I was sure about that. Yeah. And don't you hear the click of the lock opening right at the end?
Yes.
Like the the chirp of the car key opening the door.
Which kind of confused me too, because like, okay, they're all dead. But now they're back. So kind of they're zombie-like, but now they have all of this agency and intellect. And I would have liked more explanation of that. And because who brought Lewis back? Like, who buried Lewis?
Well, we're going to assume that Ellie and Rachel did, because Ellie had the strength of 9 elephants and could drag her mother back into the sour ground.
That's true.
Ellie drags her mother, and then don't the both of them drag Lewis?
Yeah.
It just didn't seem like consistent mythology to me, because it happens so quickly. Like, it just takes throwing dirt on the person, and then they suddenly rise up. I felt like there needed to be at least an evening and some, like, stars or something happening.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, you're right. It's just like a shallow layer of dirt, and then suddenly they're popping back up.
Yeah. I don't know. I was never so disappointed as I was when he got that spear to his chest. I was like, damn it. This was going somewhere for me.
I mean, to give the film some credit, I do like the sort of half-humanization of the corpses when they come back. You know, again, Like, I feel like when Gage came back in the 1989 version, there was nothing of, I feel like there was nothing of Gage left, right? He was just all, he really was an evil little stabbing monster.
aren't all 2-year-olds? I don't know.
That's true.
That's why they call it the terrible twos.
there was almost no, I mean, he did recognize his mother, but there was no humanity at all. Like, you do get the sense in this version, just because the family wants to be together and because of how Ellie is, you know, she has consciousness, she's aware of herself, she wonders why she's here. I kind of like that they weren't pure evil when they came back.
I agree. I think that was an upgrade for the film as well. And it definitely changes things. Ultimately, though, I couldn't get past Lewis because talk about not having any empathy for a character. The moment that he took Church and wanted to just release Church into the wild because he couldn't find it within himself to kill Church, I was done with that character. Because you're just going to release a domestic cat into the wild knowing what awaits that cat.
Yeah.
There was just no reason for me to like Lewis. And if the movie is going to hinge on him and his grief, why would you make decisions like that?
Well, and for as much as I wasn't as big of a fan of the casting of the cat. Now, first of all, again, this cat was much more closely related to the book. But I wasn't scared of this Church. I wanted to take it home, especially when he tried to take it off to the woods. I was like, no, I'll take you home, Church. It's okay if you're dead. I'm all right if you scratch me once in a while. Like, it's cool. We're good.
So are you saying that this adaptation or incarnation of Church lacked feline star power?
Well, no, he had star power, especially when he wore a tie to the premiere of the film, which you probably sent to me. Yes, you sent that to me. And I was like, oh, I love you even more, Church, especially knowing that you're a shelter cat, Church. Like, I love you.
Yeah, she's played by
two of them.
Yes. I think there were a few of them, and they all had little bitty ties on. It was adorable.
Yeah, I was in love with Church. I couldn't be scared.
Yeah.
But so going back to the ending of the film, I feel like maybe it's just like any, and I'm speaking as a WASP. Maybe it's just like any other white Anglo-Saxon, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant family. We're just going to deny all of our grief and pretend we like each other and go on like a family. I don't know.
And all the hatred, too.
Yeah.
I mean, when they come back, there's definitely anger and aggression toward each other. Maybe it is the perfect repressed family at the end. It's like, it's just the normal family on adrenaline or, you know.
Looks like all my Thanksgivings.
Yeah.
You know?
Pretty much.
I'm going to kill you so we can stay together, but I hate you and I want to kill you again.
But we don't actually ever tell each other we want to kill each other. We're just passive aggressive all the time.
And we'll stay together no matter what.
Yes. Keeping up appearances.
There are some interesting elements to the movie, though. So Dawn wrote a really amazing piece that's on her homeroom about connecting it to Fulcar. And I was hoping you would talk a little bit more about, like, the masks. Because the kids came out with, like, the burial scene, I was immediately thinking of, like, You're Next or Fortress, where you have sort of those animal masks and they're used in a really sort of specific way. But I
think that kind of fizzles.
It fizzles so quickly.
There's another thing that I thought could have been really great.
Oh, yeah. And in the trailer, that was, to me, when I saw those kids walking and having sort of this processional with these masks, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And then you get like a blink and you miss it and you never see those kids again except at the birthday party.
Like, oh, that's just a local tradition. Well, tell me more about that.
Yeah.
Local tradition.
I mean, when I was a kid, we did this. Like, we would walk around the neighborhood.
She said that. I was like, you're weird.
Yeah. Well,
this is why I'm scared of Southerners.
We lived across the street from a cemetery, and literally, we would look in the neighborhood for like animals that had died and give them like proper burials. Okay, now that
did
I
you
say
have,
it out
did
loud,
you have, it's did
a
you
fun
have friends?
Time.
Who's this we? Because was it you and your stuffed animals?
There were multiple kids from the neighborhood.
Stuffed animals. Wearing masks.
Listen, you have to make your fun where you make it.
Did you wear masks?
We didn't wear masks. And I was like kicking myself. I was like, talk about a missed opportunity.
Damn, we should have worn masks.
Yes. Yes.
But that was relatable to me. Okay, maybe not to you guys, but to me it was completely relatable.
Yeah, no, not relatable here.
And
so I was disappointed that they didn't sort of dial more in on that. And like, what kind of community is it, you know, that you have these kids walking around in masks with like dead animals and nobody is asking any sort of questions about it.
Oh, there goes the kids again.
Yeah.
Looks like Spot died. No, I don't know.
Well, I mean, Ellie asks a question and Rachel defines procession. She says something like it's a parade, but no one's having any fun or something like that, which is, you know, it's sort of beefing
like
up
a wedding.
The ritual.
Exactly.
Yeah. The ritual aspect. But yeah, it went nowhere. And that was such a part of the first trailer.
Yeah.
Like it defined the first trailer. Those kids and the drum beating, and they were just going to the regular pet cemetery, right?
Yeah. Right.
They didn't cross the barrier. Now, the masks did come back. Mm-hmm. Like, there was just a shot of the masks on a grave. And I didn't, I noticed that, and I was like, what does
that Ellie had one towards the end, because I feel like it showed up on her bed.
Well, and she wears one.
Yeah, afterwards.
Yeah.
She took it off and revealed herself as Judd's wife.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we also see it again after that.
Oh, well, that, I mean, that kind of makes it a little more interesting. Because the masks seem then to sort of signal like the shifting of identity that happens in death and that happens when Ellie sort of transforms or appears to transform into other people. I'm thinking of this Twilight Zone episode, which is, it's really pretty fantastic, where this aging old man makes his horrible family who hates him and...
Pigs.
Yeah, the pigs. He makes them all wear masks until midnight strikes or something. And then they turn into what the mask is in this sort of supernatural kind of thing. Like, yeah, like masks represent the changing of states or the passing from one state to another.
Well, it was almost like she was leading another procession. She was going to bring them to their death and then, of course, kind of go off and bury them as if they did earlier in the film. It's not, I mean, I know that I'm griping. It's not a horrible film. I think just if I didn't see the 89 film, I'd feel a lot better about it.
I feel like the more we've talked about it, the more it feels like everything potential kind of crumbles, including the masks and the procession.
I think it had potential and it just didn't capitalize on it.
Yeah.
No. I mean, it is on track to earn back most of its budget, so people are going to see it.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that means for future King adaptations. Although, when I was watching on social media, like, people's reactions, people seem to really like this. And for the life of me, I'm not really sure why.
Well, there is a race to, like, amp up the praise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm at a point in my life where I've decided I don't really want to waste my time reviewing things I hate or think have no value. So I guess we're talking about this. I definitely feel it has value, you know, as part of the Pet Cemetery canon, the King canon. It has a couple of redeeming qualities, and I think Ellie is really interesting.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it says something, I think, that all three of us agree that this is not a
great
movie.
Yeah, that's not a
common
thing.
We don't tend to agree.
We usually split the road.
Yeah.
You know, go see it. Make your own decision.
That was very...
See it on your Fire Stick. Don't go into
see
the
it on my Fire Stick. You guys are all welcome at my house. You can come and see it on my Fire Stick.
I just have to say, as we're speaking of sort of paying money, and I have to say that the directors, Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer, directed a film called Starry Eyes before this, which I thought was fantastic. So actually, if you're going to go and see a film by them, I would recommend that more than this.
Or go to see Beetlejuice on Broadway. Better use of your money. Liz, you're going to disagree with me on that one.
I will pass on that.
There's also a Beetlejuice bar.
Is there really?
Yeah, Beetle Bar.
There is not. Where is it? New York?
I think there's one in New York and one in maybe L.A.
Okay, that I will go to. I will go to the Beetle Bar. Do they have, like, costumes
Beetle
and stuff?
Bar, yes, Beetle Bar it is. Let's do it.
Oh, God. All right. Well, thanks, guys, for listening to us dissect Pet Cemetery. If you could follow us on all things social media at Horror Homeroom, that would be awesome. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.